Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Anderson, who's a veteran war correspondent who has reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, Northern Ireland, Chechnya, Sudan, Bosnia, El Salvador, and many other strife-torn countries. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times, has also written for Vanity Fair, Esquire, Harper's Magazine, and Outside. He's the author of Moonlight Hotel, Triage, The Man Who Tried to Save the World, The 4 o'clock Murders, and co-author of War Zones and Inside the League with his brother John Lee Anderson. His latest book just out is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Anderson.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure to be here.
And, of course, there's the old adage about those who don't understand the past are doomed to repeat it. And we are, of course, learning lessons, if you will, or we're paralyzed by lessons perhaps mislearned from the Iraq War, the Bush-Cheney-Rice-Rumsfeld folly, which is its shadow is being cast over this current situation with Syria, where most Americans and most of the representatives believe that the deceit over WMD somehow applies to this current situation. But as much as that is affecting the present, what your book brings to the table is the broader canvas where we go back to World War I. And as you say, this was a time when the seeds were planted for the Arab world, in quotes, to define itself less by what it aspires to become than what it is opposed to, colonialism, Zionism, and Western imperialism in its many forms. So that, I guess, is where the past is really haunting us, right?
That's right. That's right. And I think what we're seeing today throughout the Middle East, and most acutely at the moment in Syria, is really a disintegration of the decisions that were made at the end of World War I, almost a full century ago, in which the region was divided up with artificial borders and carved up between the French and the British empires. I think that's all coming back to haunt us. You mentioned Iraq. I was just reminded of, and I deal with it briefly in my epilogue, but when the British cobbled together Iraq in 1919, T.E. Lawrence and a number of other people who actually knew Iraq warned of what was going to happen. The people who understood the clan and tribal structure there, and on top of that, the idea of putting together Shia and Sunni and Kurds who were mutually antagonistic was a recipe for disaster. And in fact, it's very rarely remembered, but within months of the British going in, they had a full-scale revolt on their hands in 1920. So certainly you can see parallels. I saw parallels with what happened in 1919, 1920 in Iraq with the whole run-up to the Iraq War in 2003.
So in terms of the cobbling together these countries along artificial boundaries and regardless of ethnicity and history, and by the way, just apropos what you just said, it was after all and shortly thereafter the British got bogged down in Iraq in the early 20s that Winston Churchill ordered the use of chemical weapons.
They
gassed the tribesmen.
That's right.
And of course, nowadays the tables are turned. So in terms of artificial lines on a map drawn up by these colonial cartographers, one of whom, of course, is Mark Sykes, who's in your book, who Lawrence of Arabia, T. Lawrence, disdainfully described as a bundle of prejudices, intuitions, and half-sciences.
Right.
He's the guy, along with Picot, the Frenchman, that drew the boundaries that made modern Syria. Now, I understand that there's a Machiavellian element here that came to the fore in Rwanda, where the minority Tutsis were encouraged by both the French and the British colonialists to take power as a minority tribe to rule over majority tribes. And is that the same thinking that went on in Syria, where they decided to put the Alawites in charge, a minority to oversee a majority?
I mean, not exactly. But what they did in Syria, I mean, Greater Syria really consists of what we refer to as Syria today, but also Lebanon, is Palestine or what is Israel today, and Jordan. So it was a vast area, and what the British and French did at the end of the war was they basically carved it into four different countries, and in the process of doing that, cut across tribal lines, clan lines, and particularly in Lebanon, it created something very much like you're talking about. There was a very large Christian, still is a very large Christian population in Lebanon, and so the French, to control matters, came up with this very complicated formula where there would always be a Christian prime minister, while at the same time you had a Muslim president. And just demographically, over time, it became a recipe for civil war. You mentioned the Machiavellian aspect to it. I think also there was just an element of arrogance based on ignorance, and an element of wishful thinking. You mentioned Mark Sykes, and there's this famous quote of Mark Sykes. He was also, in addition to creating the Sykes-Picot Agreement, or being the co-author of it, which divided up the region, he was also a prime mover of the Balfour Declaration, which paved the way for, encouraged Jewish emigration into Palestine. And he had this quote where he said, you know, I see absolutely no reason why the resident Arab population in Palestine will have any problem with increased Jewish immigration into the area. So there was this very blithe and rather arrogant view of what was going to happen. And if problems did come along, well, European might would solve the problem. And again, I see that wishful thinking playing out today with the American government and certainly under the Bush administration, this idea that, well, of course, people, you know, they want democracy, they want to be liberated. So, we'll be treated as liberators.
And that sort of combination of missionary zeal and reckless utopianism from the neoconservatives ended up handing Iraq over to Iran.
That's right. That's
great,
right.
Great job, guys.
Right. This is an aside. I spent some time with Iraqi refugees in Syria and Jordan a few years ago, and I remember talking to a Ba'athist colonel who's now in exile, and he said, he was in Basra, which is in the Shia area of southern Iraq, and he said the day the Americans started the war, Iranian secret police were showing up in Basra and pointing out the people to be executed. And he was, according to him, he was slated for execution, so that's why he left. But it was instantaneous, and the Americans were utterly blindsided by that.
So back to your new book, Scott Anderson, again, a veteran war correspondent who's reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, Northern Ireland, Chechnya, Sudan, Bosnia, and El Salvador, among many other strife-torn countries. He is the co-author of War Zones and Inside the League with his brother, John Lee Anderson, and his latest book just out is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. And, of course, much of the book centers on Syria, the story of the moment, if you will, but just going back to the Ottomans, arguably that was the last time that the Middle East was stable. And then during World War II, of course, the Germans became allies of the Turks and then made a move on the Suez Canal, and the Brits counterattacked, if you will, via the debacle at Gallipoli, when in fact there was a place right on the Syrian and Turkish border which would have worked a lot better, right? And
that's right.
And that was what? French duplicity.
Yes. Basically, it's called Alexandretta. It's this city today in Turkey called Iskenderun. And it was really the Achilles heel of the Ottoman Empire. It was a spot that was very hard to defend, had a deep water port, which made it perfect for amphibious landings. And every military strategist who in the know, including Lawrence, advocated a landing at Alexandretta. The problem was the French, who couldn't commit any troops at that time to the Middle Eastern theater. Alexandretta bordered right on Syria, and they had already put a claim in for Syria after the war, so they didn't want the British anywhere near Syria. So instead, they advocated a landing at Gallipoli, I have to say, if you look at a map of the Ottoman Empire, and I at one point I looked up, I think there's over 3,000 miles of coastline. It would be, I couldn't find a single spot anywhere on that coastline that would make a worse spot for an amphibious landing against entrenched troops than the tip of Gallipoli. And that's exactly where, of course, the British went ashore.
Well, of course, the Australians and New Zealanders paid dearly with 25,000 killed. It was
That's right.
Very poetically shown in that film, Gallipoli. But In terms of the characters in your book, and of course one of the things I keep finding all the time as I talk to historians is that history is so often affected almost exclusively, if not dominated, by personalities as opposed to policies. And you've got some extraordinary personalities here with the German spy in Cairo, Kurt Prüfer. You've got Aaron Aronson, the agronomist and committed Zionist, and then you've got William Yale, the fallen scion of the American aristocratic Yale family, and of course you've got T. Lawrence, who later became Lawrence of Arabia.
Right. The fascinating thing about the Middle East in during this period of World War One is, of course, the vast majority of fighting and the vast majority of treasure spent and lives lost, certainly for the British and the French, was on the Western Front. So the Ottoman theater of the war was very much an afterthought. As Lawrence said, a sideshow to a sideshow. And the result of that was that people like Lawrence and these other three characters that you mentioned that are the primary characters in the book, they had extraordinary freedom of movement to kind of go out and cause trouble without much adult supervision at all. And I don't think there was another place. There were seven or eight different war theaters in World War One, and I don't think you would have ever found, if Lawrence had gone to one of those other places, he never would have had the freedom of movement that he had there. So what you had, it was this small group of men who, all of whom, one thing they shared was they all have a talent for treachery. They were all brilliant and virtually unsupervised. And so they were thrust into this moment where they were able to affect enormous change on the world stage. And these are men in their 20s and 30s. Lawrence, when the start of the Arab Revolt, when he first went off to Arabia to become the liaison to the Arab rebels, he was 28.
Well, what is extraordinary, though, is that how so many of them had these kind of, you know, manifest destiny kind of dreams. You know, the German, of course, the master spy, was influenced by the Kaiser's idea of that Germany had to have its place in the sun, and essentially an aristocratic squabble amongst the same family resulted in the slaughter of millions of men pointlessly in the so-called Great War. And then you had the American scion from the Yale family working for Standard Oil. And then you've got the Zionist who has equal sort of grand dreams of a Jewish homeland.
Right.
And then you've got the strange paradox that Chaim Weizmann's sister is working for the Germans.
Right. It was a great little detail I came across that her name was Minna Weizmann. And she was definitely the black sheep of the Weizmann family. It was a very large family from Russia. And she was committed Bolshevik. And of course, for any left leaning Jew, the idea of going into an alliance where this was when Tsarist Russia was still around, Tsarist Russia was virulently anti-Semitic. So a lot of Jews, including American Jews and even English Jews, were incredibly ambivalent about the war. And if they sided with anybody, it was towards Germany. And so Minna Weizmann met Kurt Prüfer in Jerusalem and by all accounts became his lover. And Kurt Prüfer figured out that a great way to spy on the British in Egypt was to recruit Jews who were leaving Palestine. They were being given free passage out, and a lot of them were ending up in Egypt. So he actually sent his Minna Weizmann to Cairo as a German spy, and she got uncovered there. And under very mysterious circumstances, possibly because of her brother Chaim Weizmann, who was very powerful in England, managed to escape being put in front of a firing squad.
Right, and he, Chaim Weizmann, became Israel's first president.
That's right. And never mentioned his younger sister in his he wrote about a 600-page autobiography and somehow never got around to mentioning his youngest sister.
Well, I just find, particularly in the case of the German spy, who even he knew that the Turkish attack on the Suez Canal was a folly, but nevertheless encouraged them. And of course, Lawrence, as the movie shows, did the famous counterattack. But the idea that Prufa was using Islamic radicalism against the British Empire and against the British is so extraordinary, how, as a device, that of course was used by the Dulles brothers against Arab socialism in the 50s and 60s. The mosques were deserted in those days, and they stirred up Islam in order to fight communism or socialism, culminating with what happened in Afghanistan in the Reagan administration, which of course created the blowback eventually of Osama bin Laden. So
that's right.
Talk about history repeating itself.
Yeah, it always seems like a kind of boomerang back. And yes, yeah, you're right. The Germans came up with the idea of, I mean, how do you fight the British and French empires in abroad, the outside of Europe? And the Germans came up with the idea because they were the one European power that did not have any Muslim vassal states, and the Muslim states like in Egypt and in the French case Morocco and Tunisia were bitterly resentful of their imperial overlords, and so the Germans came up with this idea of spreading jihad, of stoking an Islamic jihad that would rebel against their imperial enemies in the Middle East.
So just back to the current situation where Syria is the focus, and your earlier observation about how Arab states are more reactive in the sense that they're reacting against colonialism, Zionism, and Western imperialism as opposed to having a definition for themselves. And of course now, since the Arab Spring, there is obviously enormous turmoil, not the least of which is the very religious sectarian split between Shiism and Sunnism is being exacerbated in Syria, and it may end up exploding in a regional war. So what's your sense then of the role, because at the moment a lot of the rejection of Obama's war resolution on the left comes out of an anti-imperialism and a fatigue of intervention, if you will.
Right.
So that seems to be what's sort of governing us now, and it's an ironic moment, is it not?
It is. And getting to the point of about the way that Arab society rather defines itself by what it's opposed to rather than what it strives for. And, as you've mentioned, I've covered wars in around the world, and the one thing I've always been struck by in the Arab world is that you talk to fighters and you ask what they're fighting for. In other parts of the world, they give an idea of what they're fighting for. I mean, it could be very naive, a socialist utopia or whatever, and almost always in the Arab world, the answer is not what they're fighting for, but what they're fighting against. And I think that has played out for the last century throughout the Middle East, and so you now have a society that largely defines itself by that. What it is opposed to, and in particular with Syria. I mean, I think the great danger, as I said earlier, I think what we're seeing now is the final disintegration of those borders of the whole status quo that was created a century ago, and we've already seen it in Iraq. I mean, no American government official is going to admit it, but today Iraq is essentially three countries. So is Libya. Libya has reverted largely to the autonomous zones that were created by the Ottomans 100 years ago. And so in Syria, I think the danger of going in, and I'm just on a personal level, I'm not completely opposed to it. I think perhaps the United States needs to do something in response to what Bashar Assad has done. But I think the danger is that you actually end up empowering him. I think there's maybe a part of Bashar that would love to have a limited, I forget how Kerry described it, extremely small airstrike against
yes.
him. Because that
no,
would
an incredibly, incredibly
and it
small.
Helps
yeah.
paint his opposition as lackeys of the Americans.
Right.
So, there's really no easy way in or out of all this stuff.
Well, but the irony is, of course, is that in the sweep of history, it's the Mubarak's and the Saddam Husseins and the Assads who are in many ways, particularly in the case of, you know, the Israelis, actually, they're perfectly happy with Assad, and much of the opposition to him, the ones that we now are afraid of, are the ones that point this out. You know, and you see what happened with Mubarak. I mean, he was Israel's favorite, and now they've managed, you know, to sort of bring him back or bring his ghost back.
I mean, I think the Israelis sort of operate on the level at this point of, you know, better the devil you know.
Right.
With all their neighbors and upheaval, you just don't know where this thing is going, and obviously Syria is careening out of control, has careened out of control, and you don't know. And I think it's going to be a long time before you know what the end result is going to be. It could be a fractured country. It could be that Bashar carves out a mini Syria. It takes the Alawite community and perhaps the Christian community with him. So you may have a new nation, and it's just utterly unpredictable where it's all going, and whether the United States involves itself militarily or does the opposite. I think the thing that's fascinating at this moment is that I just don't think either side in this debate can say with a straight face what they think is going to happen or where it might lead, whether it's intervention or non-intervention. I think it's just a crazy roller coaster ride.
Well, Scott Anderson, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East.
Thank you so much, Ian. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Anderson, a veteran war correspondent who has reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, Northern Ireland, Chechnya, Sudan, Bosnia, El Salvador, and many other strife-torn countries. He's the author of Moonlight Hotel, Triage, The Man Who Tried to Save the World, The 4 o'clock Murders, and is co-author of War Zones and Inside the League with his brother John Lee Anderson. And his latest book just out is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.